Welcome to Hello Vancouver. I'm your host, Temple Lentz. We have got a fantastic show for you today. First, I'll be speaking with Democratic State Representative Sharon Wiley from Washington's 49th Legislative District. I'll also talk with Sarah Kearns from Clark County's Green Business Program and Sally Fisher from the Recycled Arts Festival, which happens down at Esther Short Park on June 24th and 25th this year. Thanks so much for joining us. This is Hello Vancouver, and I'm Temple Lentz. I'm here today with State Representative Sharon Wiley, who represents Washington's 49th Legislative District. Good morning, Sharon.
Good morning.
Now, the 49th District is largely West Vancouver. Can you describe what the district is that you cover?
It goes south to the Columbia River. It goes west to Vancouver Lake, east to Highway 205, mm-hmm. and then it kind of goes to a pie-shaped point up at 134th.
And you have been state representative for this district since 2011?
Correct. I was appointed 5 days before the end of the regular session when my representative resigned. So it was jumping right in to the final negotiations and the final days and several special sessions.
The legislature is in special session now.
Correct.
And so how long... For folks who don't know, how long are legislative sessions for the state of Washington?
Okay, in the odd-numbered years following an election in the House and every other year for part of the Senate, mm-hmm. every 2 years, that's on the odd-numbered years. The elections happen on the even-numbered years, and in the odd-numbered years, we have a 105-day regular session. In the other years when the campaign is going on, the sessions are 60 days. So there's a short session and a long session. The long session follows the new crop, basically, of legislators. And we have almost 20% turnover in the House almost every election. So there's a lot of new blood each time.
And so this is 2017. So you're coming out of
a long session,
and the regular session is over. You're in special session now.
We are. Each special session is up to 30 days, and then it has to be renewed. And we have to finish the budget or go into some kind of shutdown or continuing resolution kind of deal.
And is that the reason why a special session would be called, is basically the budget? Or what leads to it?
It's always the budget. There's hundreds and hundreds of relatively easy items to come to an agreement. In fact, there are three budgets. There's the capital budget, there's the transportation budget, and then there's the operating budget. The capital budget has to do with bricks and mortar, so it's everything except for transportation infrastructure. Then there's the transportation budget, which there's some kind of transportation budget every year. This is not a big new revenue transportation budget, and I was on the budget cabinet for developing that budget, and that passed on a bipartisan vote weeks ago.
So what's the holdup? So why what's making it go into special session this year? What's the argument?
Big picture, and this is from somebody as an observer, not just a state rep. There are two big philosophical divides between the parties, and it always comes out in the budgeting process when there is not a surplus of revenue. And one is different ideas and different beliefs about how money and jobs are created and what the government priorities are. What is the role of government? And those two differences in ideas and philosophies underlie almost every sticking point that one has, mm-hmm. Particularly around the budget. And we have constrained our spending through the initiative process and through the government enacting initiatives that turned out to be unconstitutional. So we've cut back, we've limited our property tax, which funds our schools and our counties to a large degree, and our criminal justice system voluntarily through the initiative process to a growth factor of 1% per year, no matter how many criminals move into that county or how many school kids show up for kindergarten. In addition to that, we have given a sales tax dependent state is always going to struggle as a volatile economy, we've given away a lot of sales tax breaks and B&O tax breaks, which is what businesses pay.
And so now the legislature is in special session trying to figure out the budget. And I know that one of the issues that has been the big elephant for the last couple of years has been funding education.
Exactly.
What is the, can you give a little backstory on what the heck's going on with that?
That is so complicated. As budget constraints have happened over the last 20 years, schools have had a local sales tax option, and schools are split in governance between what the state contributes and what the locals contribute. Our state constitution requires that we fund basic education amply. And as the state has pulled back and been pulled away into other needs with diminishing growth in revenue with increases in population, the locals, because they, schools are partly controlled by locals, have been willing to pony up more and more voted on property tax increases. And so what's happened is that there's been become a very, very big disparity in the property-rich counties compared to the property poor counties. So we've spent the last 6 years trying to put more money into education in a meaningful way. We have philosophical and other commitments and data-driven commitments to improve what we're doing and change and update what we're doing, which may cost more money. And then we have the last piece of the McCleary decision, which is to somehow make the property tax part fair. Right now, it's not fair, it's not equal, and what's the good news is that we've been working on it a long time. It was very hard to get the data from every school district because every single school district does it differently because it's under local control, mm-hmm. and to figure out what that fairness is. And now we have a very close agreement between the Democrats and the Republicans in the House and the Senate on what we should be doing for basic education. The disagreement is on how we pay for it and whether we make draconian cuts in other areas and whether we basically move the deck chairs or whether we increase the number of deck chairs.
So that's been something that you've been working on for a number of years now. Is it finally coming to a close? Is it resolving? Because isn't a deadline coming up for that?
That's a really good question. Most of us believe, and I think that my colleagues on the other side of the aisle would believe it too, is that somehow we need to find more money to put into education. And there's differences of opinion on the impact of where we get that money. Is it really new money? And what else does it have to take the money from one place? Does it have unintended consequences on the healthy parts of our economy? Or does it guide our economy in the right direction? Is it enough? Does it do, and what are the impacts? Some of us say that, okay, that's a great idea to put that much money into this in education. It needs it, but that's not going to work very well if your children are more hungry because you're not providing the services that help families send well-fed, solidly housed children to school.
So will we see resolution of that this year?
I think we will see a resolution. Uh-huh. We will see progress. I don't think there's any doubt about that. The policy ideas, most of the policy commitments, and there's a difference between the budget and finance piece and the policy piece. The policy piece, there's a lot of bipartisan agreement, mm-hmm. and a lot of desire to do the right thing, and a lot of good policy pieces that have been done on a bipartisan basis. The numbers are where, and what numbers are going to satisfy the Supreme Court are where the sticking point is. And there are members of the Senate and probably the House too, where people feel like it would be better to ignore the Supreme Court because they think the Supreme Court has overstepped. Others of us agree with the Supreme Court and we want to do it right.
Right. Well, that'll be interesting to watch. So when does the special session end?
30 days after April 23rd.
So is it marked in calendar days? So it's 30 days?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And does it just go indefinitely until resolution is reached?
What people don't understand is that the people that are on the negotiating team are working constantly mm-hmm. on this. They're working really very hard. Those of us that are not on that team get briefed by telephone conference call and email. Mm-hmm. We get called in to have an in-depth briefing on any proposals that have moved us forward to make sure that when we get to the end, we don't have either party sabotaging that agreement. So we're incrementally brought in, but in the meantime, we're not collecting per diem. We're back home trying to live our lives and sort of in suspended animation waiting to be called for that agreement. I'm on the finance committee, so any new taxes or changes in our tax system will have to go through the finance committee, because any changes in our revenue sources will usually go through that committee.
The legislature has been called into special session now for, you know, year after year after year. I'm wondering at what point we're going to stop calling it special and just call it a session.
I think deadlines are good. I think the pressure is good. Yeah. I don't think if you know, some of the angry, draconian things that sometimes people throw out about how to punish everybody.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like shooting everybody in the village because one person insulted somebody else. I mean, it's the reality is that there isn't, I don't know one person of either side that wants to do a bad job. I don't know one person who likes raising taxes. I don't. But I do think we need changes in our tax system, and that part of our job is to educate people. And that's why I like to be here, and I'm out there talking about why our tax system isn't enough, why it's not sustainable, why it's not adequate. We do improvements and efficiencies every year that are genuine. I have 30 years as a management consultant, and the state is constantly improving, and we're not perfect, and neither are corporations for that matter. But we have a very, very tight time with a lot of people really frightened about money and frightened about the economy and frightened about how they're going to survive in a changing world. So part of our job is not just to pass laws and create laws. Part of our job is to really explain to people and to be accountable for what we do and to be transparent about it.
What are some of the other things that you have worked on this session? So in addition to budget and education, what are some of the highlights of the session?
Well, the big elephant in my living room and really within walking distance from my front porch is the bridge over the Columbia River.
Oh, the bridge.
The bridge, yes. And we made what I have to admit is a baby step. We mm-hmm. got before Senator Benton left office, he led the parade to lock up 20 years worth of data and studies that got us to the decision that didn't get made several years ago.
Right.
Where we backed away after, I think, 15 years of work. There's $4 million worth of federal dollars, $200 million through Oregon and $200 million through Washington that went into those models and studies where every option was looked at. But people didn't pay attention until close to the end.
Right.
And we had a compromise that people didn't buy. And so that information, some of which is still valid and some of which is becoming outdated, has to be looked at. For one thing, in a year or so, if we don't use it, the money that paid for it from the federal government should be paid back, and they may try to collect. Who knows what's going to happen at the federal level.
Yeah.
So that's $200 million we would have to cough up. But that information, until we bring it forward, and that requires some assistance from staff. And I'm pleased to say that we had a bipartisan group that worked very hard for a year to get a bill passed to bring that information out, to reach out to Oregon and ask to begin the effort again, and to not be too invested in what went before, but to learn from it and do it differently. And so we got the bill passed to do that. And that's what I mostly worked on this year.
So the bill specifically, it wasn't necessarily to revive the Columbia River crossing. It was to examine, just to pull out the work and see what is still usable?
That's part of it, but also to start a process for how you move forward. And the goal of that process is to replace the existing bridge. how we replace it and what it looks like, we have to be open-minded about that in order to have any credibility. And those of us that believe one thing are suspending that and taking a fresh look. Those who tried to kill it that are now at the table are willing to not batter the old process and the old proposal in order to take a fresh look and to be really fair about it and really transparent. And so that required a lot of trust building. It also requires us to continue to do a whole lot of work on that.
Mm-hmm. So this is also enabling the legislature to go to Oregon and say, can we try again?
Right. And Oregon is officially, is verbally and publicly taking a position of they don't want to have Lucy pull the ball out from under them. But the reality is that we all need a bridge. The reality is that one of the objections in the past was that Oregon wasn't fixing their convention center choke point. If they get their transportation package through, that choke point is going to be addressed. And so they're doing a lot of the things that they need to do. And as have we, we're working on the Mill Plain entrance, and that was something that was tied up in the original proposal, but it needed to be done anyway, and we are doing it anyway, as Oregon is on their convention center piece.
Yeah, because that was something I'd heard from the Oregon side, that officials were largely saying, we have so much other transportation infrastructure to deal with that, well, not right now.
Right. But they've also said they want to see a unified response from Southwest Washington. And we have the core of that happening. We will have people appointed from both caucuses and from both the House and the Senate to work on this and to start the process. My feeling is that if we are successful in making the kind of progress I think is possible, we will be going back to Oregon to share what we've learned and where we are in January of next year, not now. They have their work to do, we have our work to do, and we have a lot to prove. We have to prove that we are ready to be serious about this and to stay there until the end of the process.
Yeah, and do you feel like the coalition that we've got is equipped to do that, that everybody is on board?
I think that not only are we committed and equipped to do that, we've all learned a lot and we've all built a lot of trust with each other, and we've all taken heat from our base for talking to the other side. All of us have been beaten up a little bit, and will be beaten up more. I mean, I'm going to go out to some of the areas that were very much against the previous bridge proposal and take my lumps, as are my colleagues.
Yeah.
So we're continuing to work on this and to take in, what we need to take in and to try to utilize that.
Well, I hope that can work. And what a sad state of affairs, but what a novel idea for our legislators from both parties to figure out how to work together to solve problems together.
Hey, wait till you see the capital budget. Unless that capital budget gets swept to fund schools because we can't come to a financial agreement, we have a capital budget that the cooperation is going to be related to. The fact that we've worked together, we've strategized together, we had dinner together, we laughed together, and we called each other out when we needed to have those conversations is going to show up in other ways too, and it already has.
Well, that's good, and I'm really glad to hear that. We have a lot of models right now of how not to do things functionally. So it's nice to hear that there is some function among all the dysfunction. So was there anything else this session? Any other big bills, major efforts that you want to talk about?
Not really. There's so many, and we all work on all of them.
Yeah.
I'm very pleased, for the most part, with our session. It would be nice to be done on time. And I think there will be years when that's possible. That's why we don't want to make it to the new normal.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Now, we're sitting here, and it is, we're recording this interview on June 1st, and tomorrow, Sharon is going to be participating in the NW Cave, well, in the No More Summit, which is largely supported by the National Women's Coalition Against Violence and Exploitation, which is led by Michelle Bart, who's been on the show before, and this summit is happening the weekend, June 2nd and 3rd, at the Hilton in Vancouver. By the time this show airs, that summit will have already happened, but Sharon's going to be one of the speakers at the summit. So, Sharon, what are you going to be talking about?
Surviving domestic violence and sexual assault. One of the jobs that I'm most proud of my contribution to was I was one of the first two positions for what was then King County Rape Relief and is now the King County Sexual Assault Resource Center. And I've been involved in starting two rape crisis centers. The first time I was ever before the Washington legislature, I was testifying on a bill related to spousal rape.
Oh my goodness.
Back in the day, you know, people think change can't happen, and that they don't make a difference. Not true. 35 years ago, I was testifying on a bill, that would make it illegal for husbands to beat up and rape their wives just because they were married. We made huge progress, and I don't want to, deny that. But we're still struggling on college campuses with a definition of what consent is.
Right.
And back in the day, we were trying to decide whether the horror stories about snuff films were real. Now we are trying to raise awareness about trafficking in little girls and little boys and humans. So we have a lot of work to do, and I'm very honored to be invited to speak. And I'm probably I was invited to speak because I have I was in an abusive relationship a long, long time ago, and I was raped in an alley outside my apartment in Detroit
at
Knife Point. And I have started two rape crisis centers as a consequence. At one point, I came very close to having a brown belt in karate. So one of the things I've been asked to talk about is how I survived and what that means
yeah.
to me.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Because that I think that is when something so traumatic like that happens, how do you face the next day?
I think there's lots of clinical work that's been done on victimology, but I think that the reality is that any event, it depends on how people are, how resilient they are already, what else is going on in their lives, and most of all, what kind of support system they have. Our goal at the Rape Crisis Center was to create a world where nobody they told would say the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. Where they wouldn't be denied medical care until they made a police report. And I found out just a few years ago that is the case. You can't get health care. You can't get paid a paid medical exam in the one hospital in Oregon, in the metropolitan Portland area, until you make a police report to a detective. And, you know, when my daughters were in high school, they called me up in the middle of the night because one of their friends had been raped at a party. And she'd waited to tell. She couldn't tell her mom at that point. And I went with her to the hospital. We waited 8 hours until the detectives got there. Clock was ticking on the morning after pill. Mm-hmm. She was very frightened. And she wasn't going to be treated until she made that police report. And that was in Oregon. And I was living back here then, and I was absolutely shocked because when we started the Rape Crisis Center in King County, we trained nurses everywhere to take rape kits. Mm-hmm. We just recently put more money into testing rape kits that had been sitting around waiting for DNA tests for 10, 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
And that's going on all over the country. So, you know, three steps forward, two steps back. We still have a lot of pieces to carry forward. We have not solved the problem. And the problem is more complicated than saying rape is a violent crime. We are in a free speech society with a coercive sexuality mode and women that are still not equal. We've made progress, but it's still okay for a lot of people for women to not be treated as equal in the law, We have a lot to do on this subject.
Well, thank you very much for participating in that and for being a part of helping other people as they're working through it.
Well, that's what, you know, public service is really an honorable effort. And those of us that do that get a lot more out of it than we give.
Well, thank you. And I've been talking with State Representative from Washington's 49th Legislative District, Sharon Wiley. Sharon, thank you so much for talking with me today.
My pleasure.
And now let's listen to the song, She's What I Want, from local band The Pearls.
Some guys born a woman that's meek, or a woman that'll turn the other cheek. I was raised to understand how a real woman can love a man.
With Sally Fisher from Clark County's Department of Public Health. Hey, Sally.
Hi, Temple. Thanks for having me here today.
Happy to have you. So you have kind of a long and involved title. So can you, rather than me butchering it, can you let me know what is your title with the county?
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. I am an environmental outreach specialist with the Solid Waste and Environmental Outreach Program, which comes under public health.
That must be incredible on your business card.
It's a really big card.
Now, one of the main things that you work on, your key program is neighborhood outreach?
It is, residential outreach. So we have a schools program, a business program, we have our master composter recyclers, and then we have residential outreach, and that's what I do.
So what falls under that?
Well, the Green Neighbors program is kind of the broad overreaching program, but a lot of different things happen through Green Neighbors, like your recycling events where people can take hard to recycle items on a weekend and dispose of them at different locations throughout the county. We do a cart tagging program where we go out and check out people's recycling carts and give them tips for how they could become better recyclers or just thank them for being really great recyclers. And honestly, most people are really great recyclers. So we also do the Recycled Arts Festival, which is coming up, and that's our biggest outreach opportunity of the year to reach out to the citizens of Clark County, have a great celebration over the weekend, and show them more ideas and ways that they could reduce waste.
And it's a really cool program. And it's, so it's down in Esther Short Park.
It is.
And it's always the last weekend of June.
It's the last full weekend of June, which about every 5 years throws everybody completely off. So if both Saturday and Sunday land in June, that's the weekend.
Okay, so what are the dates of it this year?
This year, June 24th and 25th.
Excellent.
Coming right up.
So that is coming right up.
Yes.
And so tell me about what is involved in that. For somebody who hasn't been before, what could they expect?
Well, the main thing they can expect is lots of really amazing art. All of our artists, and we have usually between 150 and 160 artists in the park that weekend.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a lot. And they make art out of things that most people would consider garbage or junk. Or maybe they'd go so far as to know it goes in the recycle cart, but they don't look at it and see dogs or bird feeders or furniture. But these people do. And it's just really fun to see where their imagination takes them with all this stuff.
And so how long has it been going on?
This will be the 12th year.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So it's come a long way.
It has. And it's really... Just in the time I've been here, I know that it's just physically grown a lot.
Oh, yeah. It's really grown. The first year we had 30 artists in the park, and we had, we think about 3,000 people came, mm-hmm. but we give full credit for that to the farmer's market, which is next door. And they just kind of wandered over to the park to see what was going on.
Right.
And now we get about 40,000 people over the weekend. And I already mentioned that we get between 150 and 160 artists.
So do the artists and vendors come from mostly from around here?
We try to get as many as we can who are local. But we do get people from as far away as the East Coast. We have some people from Montana this year, ladies coming up from Arizona. But we do try to get our local artists engaged before we bring those folks in.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Now, something that I remember from going through that I thought was a really neat touch was you have all these vendors and they're kind of scattered throughout the, well, they're not really scattered. They're on a nice path throughout the park and they're well organized. But periodically, you'll see signage that has some messaging.
Yes, because the whole point of Recycled Arts Festival is education for us. We try to do it in a really fun way that's more spontaneous and makes people want to come and participate in it. But we do put little facts along the paths that talk about different recycling things, you know, like how many aluminum cans you might save in electricity if you turned off your TV at night and those kinds of things. So you can look at the different facts. You can also see at each artist booth a sign that talks about why they chose to do recycled art instead of art out of virgin materials. And they gives kind of a little artist statement about their lifestyle. So we really count on those artists to be our educators for the weekend. That's their job.
Now, what else is there? I recall there's an area that kind of has a bunch of stuff in it and talks about these are the things that we find in a landfill.
Yes. The Tossed and Found exhibit is done by Waste Connections. And they go to the transfer station for about, they've been doing it for about 3 months now this year, and they pull things out of the transfer station that people have dumped as garbage, but really should have been given to a thrift store or to a neighbor or given to for another purpose. They should have been reused. And we get things like brand new barbecues in boxes.
Oh my gosh.
1 year we got 30 sets of golf clubs. It just unbelievable what people will take and just throw on the floor.
So after you do that exhibit, what happens to all that stuff?
It's all donated to thrift stores. We used to give it away through kind of an auction process, but it just became too complicated. So now people have to go to the thrift store the following
week. That's good for me to know, because I've gone to that and said, I want that thing.
Yeah.
And they were like, well, we can't help you with that. You're going to have to like... stalk it and track it down at
Goodwill. Right. And we answer that question all weekend long.
What else? Are there other components, other things at the Recycled Arts Festival people can expect?
Oh, yeah. There's just a lot of great stuff going on all weekend long. We have live music on the stage from beginning to end. And we try to find kind of an eclectic mix of music. We don't do cover bands. We do marimba and zydeco. Really fun stuff. You can dance. You can just come and celebrate if you want to. You don't even have to do any shopping. We also have our sculpture garden, and that's a feature of larger pieces that artists have made. And we put those down on the bricks by the fountain, and then the public can vote for their favorite. So then at the end, we'll award a People's Choice Award for the public's favorite sculpture that weekend. And folks really love to vote. They like to vote, and they like to put a pin in the map that shows where they came from. They like to find their house. So we do have a map there, and we have people put a pin in so that we can see where people are coming from and where they're hearing about the festival. And it's really fun for us to look at that later. And it also helps us with our marketing and to determine our target audiences. But we do get pins from all over the world. We had to make a bigger map because we weren't including enough geography to include all the people who come. This year, we have a new special feature called the Procession of the Species. And for people who are from Olympia or who have been in that area, they've been doing this for 22 years. Mm-hmm. And it's a parade where people make masks or costumes to dress up like animals or made-up species. It doesn't have to be a real animal. And we're going to do a little parade through downtown with a band leading the parade. And I think it'll just be really fun.
That is really cool.
Yeah, we're just going to celebrate arts and the community and the environment. So that'll be Sunday morning at 10 o'clock.
Sunday morning at 10. And so if folks want to catch that, they can just come down to the park at that time and
see
it.
Yeah, because we need watchers too.
Of course.
Yeah.
Now, something that I know that they do in Olympia is they have sort of like workshops in advance for people who want to make their costumes and that sort of thing.
Yes, and we're doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. So we still have, there's three more opportunities. There's three more workshops that can be found by going to our recycledartsfestival.com website. And then there will be all day Saturday at the festival, a chance to make a mask if you want to make one then and come back Sunday and be in the procession.
Oh, nice. So there's no deadline.
Nah.
You can just show up and do it.
That's right.
Excellent.
All are welcome. We have three rules. There can be no written words. There can be no spoken words and no live animals other than service animals. So, you know, we're trying to keep politics and agendas out of it and just really celebrate the day.
That sounds like a lot of fun. Now, you already said it once, but just one more time. What's the website where folks can get more information?
It's recycledartsfestival.com.
Great. Now, I want to take a couple of minutes and talk more about the neighborhood and community programs. So when it comes to Green Neighbor, what makes up the Green Neighbor program?
Well, it was designed with the intent to help people live more sustainably at home. So our goal is to provide the information that people need to do things at home that they want to do to live a more green lifestyle. So we have an extensive website. There's workshops offered throughout the year. And we try to support all the different agencies in Clark County who are doing things that would support green neighbors. So we have a big calendar, and it's got everybody in the county can send information to us, and we'll put it on the calendar for people to know about their upcoming events. For example, the Wildlife Refuge might have a bird walk, or Columbia Springs might be doing a workshop. So we try to get everybody included in that. And then I do a monthly newsletter to highlight what's coming up for that month and to remind people that they can look at the calendar and see for themselves.
Now, I find that the people who work in your field are really dedicated to their work. I mean, you're one of them. And I'm wondering how you got into this field. What led you to eventually be in this position?
Oh, well, I don't have a good answer for that. But I got my degree in business and psychology with the intent of being a human resources manager. And I did that for 10 years. And it just wasn't my thing. There were aspects to the job that I just didn't really care for. So I just went off in a completely different direction. And I ended up working at the garbage company And from the garbage company, it was kind of a springboard into solid waste at the county. So I think life took me there rather than me picking that and going toward it. And I think that's true of a lot of people in our field, that they just find their passion and then that's where they stay because that's what they love.
Well, is there anything else that that you're working on that's coming up that you want to talk about that I haven't asked you about?
Well, I would love to mention that on July 23rd, we're having our natural garden tour, and it's really an awesome opportunity for people. We have 15 houses on the tour this year, and these are all private citizens who have said, yes, people can come and walk through my yard that day and take a look around, and we'll have plants labeled and different natural gardening techniques labeled, and it's just a really fun day. The homeowners are always there to answer questions. We'll have master gardeners in each yard. So if you're into gardening and you want to learn how to do it with less chemicals, it's a great opportunity to come and see what your neighbors are doing.
That's really cool. So natural gardening, how is that defined? What makes something a natural garden versus any other?
Well, the criteria for the tour is you can't use any chemicals in your yard. But there's a lot of things you can do to offset that, because we all know that weeds grow and you get diseases and you get invasive bugs. So there's a lot of techniques you can use to offset that. That don't require the use of chemicals. And so that's what we're trying to help people with, because they get frustrated with their yard when it looks crummy. And so we wanted their yards to look beautiful without the use of chemicals. And you can do that. And these people are a marvelous example of how that can happen.
Fantastic. So that's July 23rd.
Yes. It'll be from 10 to 4. And you can also go to the Green Neighbors website to get information on that. And it's all free. It's self-guided.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So the Green Neighbors website is, what's the website for that?
It is clarkgreenneighbors.org.
Right. Well, Sally Fisher from Clark County, thank you so much for joining me. We've got the Recycled Arts Festival coming up on June 24th and 25th, the Natural Gardening Tour that's coming up on July 23rd. You can find out more about these at recycledartsfestival.com and at clarkgreenneighbors.com. Sally, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And now one more song from the Pearls, Kisses.
Let's go. I take in like a cigarette, deep inhale and hold my breath. Well, give your kisses to me.
I'm here with Sarah Kearns, who works with Clark County, and she runs the Green Businesses Program, among other things. Now, Sarah, you have kind of a complicated title, so I'm going to let you introduce yourself.
Hi, Temple. I'm Sarah Kearns, and I'm an environmental outreach specialist in the Solid Waste and Environmental Outreach Program at Clark County Public Health.
Fantastic. I'm glad I let you say that because I would have killed it. But thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So the one major program that I know that you do is the Green Businesses Program. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I'd love to. Clark County Green Business is a recognition program. And what I really want to do is work with businesses throughout Clark County and help them minimize their environmental impacts and also lend a little recognition for all the hard work that they put in.
So what qualifies a green business?
To become a green business, you need to meet some minimum requirements, and there are six different areas that I like to look at. And the first step is in a community engagement and employee engagement. And what I look for is that every business has to have a green team or a green leader. And so what that person or that group is kind of the champions of working on different environmental projects and keeping things moving, communicating with management if that's needed, those types of activities, and really are the drivers and the people who push for these programs. And so following that, then we look at the environmental criteria. And so to be a green business, you need to look at areas of your operation and processes like energy consumption, water use, waste and recycling is a big one. And lots of people have questions on that one. So I work very closely with that. And hazardous materials is another area. And so we just kind of, once we have all the people in place who are wanting to do the work, then we dig in and look at those environmental areas.
Nice. Are there specific kinds of businesses that are more likely to be in the program or that you target more?
Sometimes. When the program first started, which was back in 2011 as a pilot project, we tried to really handpick and select lots of different types of businesses from various sectors and sizes and really get a broad broad input into kind of the development of the program. And since then, I sort of have taken a different approach and worked with the businesses that have come to me in seeking either the opportunity for recognition or the assistance.
Because, yeah, it seems like, you know, something that's in manufacturing or like a dry cleaner or something where there's a lot of material would be a really good candidate. Are there also green businesses that are like, you know, small law offices or a boutique or things like that?
I have worked with all different types of businesses, and it really is one of the more fun aspects of my job. I've worked with retail, and it's very, you know, common to work on. I've been into manufacturers, and I've worked with grocery stores and other all sorts of different types of offices and doing lots of different activities.
Is there something like from some of the businesses you've worked with, like the most dramatic change that you've seen?
I think so. The model of the program is really towards incremental changes. And so I like to work with people on not striving for environmental perfection right out of the gate, but more of a process to help them chip away at some of their environmental impacts and what they want to work on. I have seen a lot of amazing success stories out there. And that's one of another great aspect of my job is being able to tout other people's hard work and really make it known in the community what they're doing. For example, Cadet Manufacturing is a green business, and they were recently this year named Green Business of the Year in the large business sector for our Clark County Green Awards. And they have made a huge effort over time, not a dramatic change all at once, but they've continued to evaluate processes and reduce waste in their shipping and packaging. And they recently switched over to recycling film plastic as opposed to throwing that away in the garbage. And they're diverting significant amounts from the landfill in doing so.
Nice. Now, are there business benefits to trying to be more environmentally conscious? I mean, I think, you know, there's the general understanding of trying to put less in the waste stream and a lot of the generally understood sort of eco, you know, to blanket categorize it. But from a business perspective, why does it matter?
So for the most part, anything that results in resource conservation, you know, minimizing waste, conserving energy, all of those things can reduce operating costs for a business. So often there is that cost savings. And depending on the size of the business, it could be an extraordinary amount of money if it's a manufacturer, for instance, or if it's a small retail establishment that might be able to do something like eliminate an invoice printing or something as simple as that. But when that process is repeated every day throughout the year, there can be some paper savings, for example.
So if somebody has a business and they're interested in learning more about this and possibly trying to get into the program and seeing what they can do, is there a website they can go to?
So the Clark County Green Business website is clarkgreenbiz.com.
So that's one of the programs that you work on. What else falls under your umbrella?
I do a lot of outreach and education around waste and recycling. Mm-hmm. So I do a lot of work in Clark County. About 50% of our total waste stream is from the business community. And within that group and within that quantity, there's a significant amount of food waste that's being generated by the business community. So, and that includes, you know, that's from citizens and our residents going out to dinner at a restaurant. And restaurant, you know, we have some great food options in Clark County these days. And so one of my challenges with all of those restaurants is to work with them on food waste composting. And so we have a campaign right now, and we're providing assistance and resources to restaurants to offer services to divert food waste from the landfill and compost that material instead.
Oh, great. So do they compost it themselves, or is there like a composting service they send it to, or how does it work?
Sometimes people ask me about that, and we do not necessarily encourage on-site composting. That's quite a bit of material, and we all know that restaurants are, you know, the people who work there are very busy people, and we wouldn't want to take their attention away from making us the most tasty food possible. So we've partnered, and Waste Connections, our garbage hauler, offers a service to collect food waste from businesses and schools in Clark County, and they collect all the material in green carts that are similar to our recycling bins at home, and they take it to a place called Dirt Hugger, which is in the Columbia River Gorge, and they compost it there, and they create a really nice soil amendment that is then sold to orchards and other farms in Clark County.
Oh, wow. Well, that's really cool. So if somebody's interested, if they have a restaurant and they're interested in participating, what do they do?
I would suggest that they visit the Green Business website. We have some great resources and a simple step-by-step instructions and a good partnership with Waste Connections. And between Clark County and Waste Connections, we can work together to create a good system to help you compost.
Excellent. Are there other programs that you have that you're working on that we should know about?
One of the aspects of the Green Business Program is to really bring the business community together around environmental topics and sustainability so that they have the ability to learn from each other. There are all sorts of challenges that are mimicked no matter what business you're in. And so we offer monthly networking events called Green Business Morning Blend, and they're held on the third Thursday of every month from 8 to 9 a.m. And our locations go throughout the county in an effort to bring together people from the various areas. And it's free, and anyone who wants to join in and learn a little bit more about how green teams work or what types of energy conservation programs might be available to them, it's a great opportunity.
And so that's every third Thursday of every month at 8 a.m. And if they want information on what the location is each month, it's again on the Clark Green Biz website?
You got it. ClarkGreenBiz.com.
So you said that Waste Connections was a big partner in like the composting program for restaurants. Who are the other partners that you work with to accomplish your goals?
The Green Business Program works really closely with Clark Public Utilities, as well as the City of Vancouver. Clark Public Utilities plays a huge role in helping our businesses evaluate their energy usage and needs. And City of Vancouver is a huge partner with us as well.
So Clark County has a number of environmentally based programs that seem to do a lot of work in the community and are doing a lot of good. But I hear the question occasionally of, is this actually the role of a government organization? So what I'm wondering is, what is the benefit of having a program like yours, like Green Businesses, operate under the umbrella of Clark government?
Well, one of the aspects and the reason I'm doing the work that I'm doing is that we're required by the state of Washington to have a solid waste management plan. And so within that requirement, we need to meet certain recycling and waste diversion goals. And so from that lens, I feel really good about being able to reach out and work with all of the great businesses who I work with in terms of they're really helping us meet our goals in some ways, as well as reducing waste and cutting costs.
Oh, that's really interesting. I think a lot of people, I know I didn't know that, that actually a lot of what's created here is a way of solving problems that are mandated by the state. Now, something that interests me is how people get into the jobs they're in. And especially in the environmental field, in some capacity, I find that the people who are in those jobs are like super dedicated and committed to what they're doing. So how did you get on this track?
Wow, that's a great question. I think I feel like I have the best job in Clark County. I absolutely love my job, and you're absolutely right. I'm very passionate about what I do, and I love it. I got into it from the perspective of wanting to be in the environmental field, I think. Right out of the gate, I did study environmental planning in college and geography, and from there was realizing that I wanted to make a difference by working with organizations. I think organizations are fascinating. And we all go, you know, we all have a job or go to a church or, and all those types of organizations, they kind of operate as little organisms. And so I enjoy working on those systems and within those systems to help people make a difference. It's really what my role is really about helping people. And I think that that's a fun part of what I do.
Well, you're doing a fantastic job at it, and these programs are really valuable in bringing a lot to Clark County. So, Sarah Kearns, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's our show. Thank you so much for being here with us. And thanks to all of our guests, State Representative Sharon Wiley, Sarah Kearns and Sally Fisher from Clark County, and local band The Pearls. I'm your host, Temple Lentz, and this has been Hello Vancouver. For more about the show, visit hellovancouver.us, and don't miss our next live show on June 28th at 7 p.m. at Warehouse 23 in Vancouver.
KXRW is brought to you by the generous support of Hosley Eco Automotive. Hosley Eco is your source for fast, friendly, and honest service. Hybrid and electric car qualified and home of the 3-year, 36,000-mile warranty. Find out more at HosleyEcoAutomotive.com.